The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey everyone, welcome to a good football show. I am Matt Straub, and this is your Wild Card Weekend preview show. We will be previewing all six games on the schedule. To do that, I'm joined by John Daigle, Pat Daugherty, and Denny Carter. Guys, as the playoffs get started, before we preview these games, I quickly wanted to talk real life fandom for a second, because it seems like, as I look at the big picture view here, we may not have a single horse in this race among us. I'm a Falcons fan, as we know, so my life is over. But as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, we have Daigle, who is like a semi-retired Cowboys fan. Pat is still trying to figure out what happened during the Jeff Fisher era in St. Louis. And then there's Denny, who is geographically somewhere between the Ravens and the Washington football team in like this mid-Atlantic football purgatory. Do I have all of that correct, for starters?
Yeah. And I also wouldn't root for a team if my life depended on it.
Denny was a bandwagon Dolphins fan growing up, is what he doesn't want to
do. Oh, yeah, bandwagon. Yes, I latched on to a team that was the most devastating to watch and root for the entire decade of the 90s. That was fun. I liked that.
63-7, is that what ended the fandom, Denny?
No, a girl's did. So once that happened, I stopped caring about football, and then fantasy football happened and I just completely stopped rooting for them.
It's just unfortunate, because I don't think fandom is necessarily an evil thing, but the people like we come across in social media, because unless you like go out to bars and whatnot and talk to more people, those are the reasonable ones. But on social media, it's the worst of the worst. It's the ones who will say negative things about you and attack you personally just for not believing the Steelers can win a game they were trailing by 30 points in and kick two field goals to make the box score look respectable just 2 weeks ago in the same matchup. So yeah, like I really don't mind fandom. It's just it's hard to find the good ones out there.
Some fans are so passionate about their teams that they will make fun of a man's haircut. And I can say this from personal experience after Giants fans who now they don't like Joe Judge, by the way.
Now they're
against Joe Judge. Apparently they always were, even in June when they were roasting Pat about it. But they get very boisterous online. You're right.
Yeah, I went back and looked at some of the tweets at me from last summer, like some of the counts, and without exaggerating, like the people were tweeting at me last summer saying, like, I didn't know what I was talking about, like, you're just a hater. Like, Joe Judge is amazing. Like, their bios were all updated to like Judge out, clean house. One had an Avi that was just Joe Judge with a big circle and an X through him. And these were all the same people. Again, my write-up was charitable to Joe Judge too.
The good news is that we still have a chance to get Joe Judge back in our lives, which I genuinely really want. Like, some people take the route in saying only positive things about fantasy and football overall. Like, I get my joy in the NFL and just making fun of the negativity and the cronyism involved in the league. It's hilarious how atrocious the business process is. And I think that's what makes it fun. And so, like, the fact that we know that Caserio and Easterby are linked to the three Patriots dudes in McDaniels, Brian Flores, and Joe Judge, once again, is hilarious. And so it would not be shocking at all to see Judge, like, recrop here with the Texans.
They need to pray it's Flores. And by the way, Matt, I don't have an NFL team, but I get my lizard brain fix from the University of Missouri and the St. Louis Cardinals. And yeah, I mean, I will defend sports tribalism, by the way. I think it's kind of amazing that you're like, you're just stuck with teams from birth. Like, I think it's fun that you can't like shop around and you just like get saddled with your parents' like psychic guilt and energy from their fandom. from those teams. And I think it's like character building. It's part of life. I think you shouldn't ever be a flipper. You need to take whatever burden is placed on you at birth and stick with that for the rest of your life.
It's more gratifying.
I'm also just happy that Daigle gets to combine, you know, slamming cronyism and the Texans all in the same breath. That's like, that's got to be a dream for you, Daigle. That's it right there.
How, I mean, the malpractice of that organization. Like, on a serious note, remember, there were only three minority hires last year. Robert Saleh, and then David Coley, the only black coach hired among that group, and then Ron Rivera, who's Hispanic. And now it leaves only Mike Tomlin as the only black coach in the NFL. Again, it just comes down to cronyism, and as Evan Silva says, the cocoon. And it's never been truer than looking at the examples of this year. They didn't even give Coley pretty much a hiring press conference. They just sent him out to the firing squad and said, hey, do this without Deshaun Watson and take all the blame on behalf of us, and then sent him away after 1 year. And I'm not even saying he did like a terrific job. He had his flaws, but at least he always went to the media after his games and admitted those flaws. He had a couple of fourth down blunders throughout the year. But also just the fact that now also removing Tim Kelly, again, they're going to retread the Patriots cycle. We already know what they're going to do, and that is just comical. Frustrating and comical.
It's Joe Judge. They will have to, like, they're going to have to repossess the franchise from the McNair family, because that will just be the darkest day in Houston sports history.
Cully winning four games and being competitive in another at least three or four, if you adjust for roster and everything else going on with the Texans, that's the equivalent of winning four straight Super Bowls.
Yeah,
so I think you did an okay job.
Pat, just so you know, there is no Texans Saturday afternoon game this weekend. I confirmed. I know you're concerned about that, but it is not on the schedule.
Yeah, no, it's not allowed to be the Texans and Bengals at the same time, but it always has to be at least one of the Texans or Bengals in the Saturday afternoon wildcard game. This year was the Bengals' turn.
All right, well, that segues nicely to the first game on our agenda here. It's the Raiders at the Bengals, Saturday afternoon on NBC. PointsBet has Cincy as 5-point favorites, a total of 48.5. Now, Joe Burrow has thrown for four touchdowns in a game exactly twice. It happened in Week 16 and 17. When he threw for a combined 971 yards, 8 touchdowns, no interceptions. That was before sitting out Week 18. So these were not good times for the Bengals passing game. These were great times. Pat, do these fireworks resume for Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase, and friends in the playoffs?
Well, we definitely hope so, don't we? But we also know the Bengals have been rather like game plan specific, opponent specific, and the Raiders held up kind of surprisingly well against the pass almost all year. And their big vulnerability was on the ground. And we know that anytime basically you gave the Bengals an excuse to establish it, they established it really, really hardcore. And Joe Burrow does have the knee tweak. Joe Mixon missed Week 18 with the coronavirus. I guess maybe he's conditioning his stamina. Could be a question mark. Probably not. They'll probably both be fully ready to go. And yeah, you would think that despite the Raiders, you know, despite their main weakness being on the ground, it's not like they're a stay away unit from the air, despite overachieving there. And just, yeah, after that awe-inspiring success down the stretch of both, T. Higgins was third in receiving yards after Week 12. And then, you know, what Ja'Marr Chase did to close out the season, you would just hope they realize that they're just essentially indefensible. I mean, Joe Burrow averaged almost 9 yards per attempt this season. I mean, they're just doing damage down the field at a level you rarely see. Really, honestly, that only Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs have done the past 3 or 4 years when it comes to like pure downfield damage. And you would certainly hope that they don't go all in on an established game plan. They've realized the superpowers they have with this passing attack. But yeah, the Raiders, that's where they were most vulnerable all year, is the run. So I wouldn't be surprised by anything from a team that will take what you give them in the Raiders and the Bengals, excuse me.
Is it no longer the novel coronavirus now that we've reached the wild card round?
Yeah, you know, it just depends. Sometimes, you know, the novel is just going to make it so much funnier. So
there are qualifiers, apparently. This actually, just like every other game except 49ers-Cowboys, is a rematch from earlier this year. And if you recall, that's the approach, like Pat said, with the run the Bengals took the last time these two teams played, with 32 running back carries to 29 passes overall. Even against Gus Bradley's cover three, who we know Joe Burrow has been sterling against cover three this year, but it didn't matter as they let him sit back and only threw for 140 yards and a touchdown. That game was actually close too, with that run first dumbed down approach, 16-13 midway through the third quarter, and then the Bengals blew it up because of two huge Joe Mixon runs and finished winning by 20 points. So overall, I am worried about the game script for this first round, and I am somewhat worried about the Bengals getting out of this one safely like most people are assuming. It's not even what the Raiders are really doing to counteract. I just think the Bengals can be their own worst enemy, remember, like you said, Matt, the last two games of the year sort of painted a faux picture of what the Bengals offense is, since they were forced to do that. A rivalry game against the Ravens, mm-hmm. against Harbaugh. And then, of course, the Chiefs game, with the last time we saw Joe Burrow, in which the Chiefs took an early lead and forced the Bengals to throw more. And so overall, I do sort of worry about the fireworks in this game and think the Raiders can hang around here.
Part of me thinks, and this is despite, you know, what I wrote in my DFS article, which you can find on the site, that the Bengals are just all in on keeping their foot on the gas with this lethal passing game. Only the Buccaneers had a higher pass rate over the season's final 6 weeks than the Bengals. That was following a first 12 weeks of the season where the Bengals had a 55% pass rate, which was among the, you know, it was in the bottom half of the league as far as pass rate goes. Look overall, it just seems like this offense is ready and willing to throw pretty much no matter what, kind of like the Bucs. You know, we know that the Bucs throw even when they're ahead in the game. I'm not saying Mixon is not a worthy play. In fact, I love the spot. You know, everything screams that, you know, Mixon could be in for kind of a blow up game, especially with his route participation and his targets in recent weeks. But thinking that Mixon is like pure leverage against the Burrow and the pass catchers, I think is a little too far. I think that this team has discovered, hey, no, we can do this. Like, we can go completely full out with Chase and Higgins down the perimeter. And Burrow has shown that he is ready. He's willing to throw it up to them at any point in the game.
Quickly on Mixon, we saw his passing game usage come back in those week 16, 17 games, 14 targets, 13 catches, 110 yards. So Daigle, like, either way, game script wise or Bengals approach wise, would you say you're bullish on Mixon in this spot?
I am bullish on Mixon in this spot, but will be the first one to admit that we just don't know when that passing game is going to stick, since it's come and gone multiple times throughout this year. Even this pass game against the Raiders, 30 carries but zero catches. So I wouldn't say I'm trusting the passing game usage so much as I'm trusting the carries and the workload. And a good pivot spot for DFS, since most people will probably be on Burrow on the passing attack. Especially because, as we noted, that cover three that Gus Bradley runs, remember, Tyler Boyd led the team with a 27% target share as a slot player who settles into the zone the last time these two teams played. So it would not be shocking at all, since the Raiders limit explosive passing plays, that Boyd is the one to actually lead in targets and catches. Not that he'll lead in production, since we know that only gets you so far, a la Zach Ertz, but he could genuinely lead in targets again in this game.
All right, for the Raiders, Darren Waller returned, and the Raiders, by the way, making just their second playoff appearance in the last 19 seasons. And in that win over the Chargers, Waller drew 9 targets, had just 2 catches for 22 yards. Meanwhile, Hunter Renfrow had just 13 receiving yards, his lowest of the season, saved his day with a couple of touchdowns. But Danny, is there a clear connection for you here where, with Waller back, that's what put a dent in Renfrow's production? And big picture, who are we up on, who are we down on in this Raiders passing game?
Yeah, you know, Pat and I talked about how Waller's return to the lineup would be not so great for Renfrow. And then, of course, he covers up an otherwise underwhelming game with a couple touchdowns. And, you know, if you point to it statistically or fantasy-wise, there's no argument. Oh, well, he did okay. He did great, actually. But, you know, the opportunity really had been sucked away a little bit by Waller taking some of those middle-of-the-field intermediate targets. And by the way, Darren Waller's week 18 peripherals were way better than, you know, his actual numbers. He ran a route on 94% of Derek Carr's dropbacks, which is tremendous. He commanded a 24% target share. You know, this week, just for instance, on DraftKings, you know, he's $1,000 less than Travis Kelce, which I think means that Waller's going to see a lot of rostership in this, on this slate. But and the Bengals are not a, you know, they're neither a great nor a terrible tight end matchup, but his involvement in the offense was very good last week.
The only other pivot in the passing game would be Zay Jones, who's quietly commanded 9 targets per game in his last 4 starts. But also, he's just a floor play because he's gone over 70 yards one time all year, hasn't scored a touchdown since week 1. So you'd really just be taking the reception floor of any of your playoff-only formats if you pivoted to him.
So Josh Jacobs is averaging 25 touches the last 3 weeks. Pat, how does the old matchup against the Bengals look for him?
The Bengals allowed the 12th most running back fantasy points on the year, and it was actually the 6th most over the final 4 weeks, but it was kind of just because of fluky rushing touchdown luck, where they were actually bottom 5 in rushing yards allowed on the season, kind of like a replacement level yards per carry against. And really, I think it's a matchup where it's up to the Bengals. If the Bengals put the pedal to the metal, they're going pass heavy. If they get up early, it's hard to see the matchup like mattering for Josh Jacobs because they're going to have to pass. And we hope that like those increased passing game targets remain there and he can at least stay in much more involved like he has been in the second half, really the final two thirds of the season as a pass catcher. These two teams played in week 11 and the Raiders trailed basically the entire game. It was close to like the fourth quarter. They only attempted 18 rushes. And that's just always a risk against the Bengals. If you're playing against this explosive passing offense, if you're playing behind chasing points the entire game, you're not going to be able to establish as much as you want to. So they're not a great matchup on paper. And it's really a lot. Every game when it comes to running backs is like game script dependent. But I think this one is going to be like particularly sensitive for the Raiders rushing attack when it comes to game script.
The only thing to watch here is that in his third game back from the COVID list, Jalen Richard did play a season-high 30% of snaps and ran as many routes as Josh Jacobs, 20 apiece. And so if we see more involvement or that game script to change, we're at least questioning if Jacobs has the pass-catching role any longer since Richard is apparently healthy and good to go for that role.
Pat wincing as he hears that news.
We were depending on Jacobs' targets, but remember, like, he was averaging 6 yards a catch. Not like he was doing anything with those targets. It was just nice for him to have the pass-catching floor, so he's also been pretty poor as a running back. So if we're taking those targets away, it's somewhat scary for his floor if you think the Bengals will advance in this round. Again, I think it's going to be close. It would not be shocking. Like we talked about with the Raiders and the Chargers, for a team like the Bengals who have screwed up in big spots this year to screw up again.
Oof. Bengals fans do not want to hear that with a 30-plus year drought between playoff wins. As we gear up for wildcard weekend, the NBC Sports Predictor app powered by PointsBet has you covered with Sunday Night 7. We are giving you a shot to win $1 million twice this weekend. It starts on Saturday by predicting what will happen between the Raiders and Bengals in Cincinnati. Then another $1 million is up for grabs during the Steelers-Chiefs matchup Sunday night. Download today from your app store or visit NBCSports.com/predictor for more information. And we will get to the Steelers-Chiefs game later in the show, but first let's answer a Sunday Night 7 question for this first game. Bengals and Raiders, quick around the room, who wins and by how many points?
We don't know. None of us know who's going to win. The Bengals are going to win. It's a 5-point spread. Okay. The Raiders, okay, basically as a miracle of a playoff team, you've ever seen so many narrow victories. I think that ends this week. The Bengals win and they win by 10.
I have the Raiders covering. I think the Bengals eke it out by 3 or 4 points.
Yeah, Bengals win by 2.
I am worried. I'm kind of worried. I would rather see Joe Burrow for the rest of the postseason personally.
Than Hunter Renfrow?
Okay.
Just barely.
I think Zay Jones, the most important player in the NFL? Come on, get out of
just
here.
Barely.
All right, next up, the Patriots at the Bills on Saturday night. PointsBet has Buffalo's 4-point favorites, a total of 44. And in two games for Josh Allen against the Pats this season, we've seen a total clunker. That was week 13 at home. Then on the road, week 16, he went for 300-plus yards, 3 touchdowns. Danny, what are you expecting this weekend, round 3, from Allen and this Bills passing game?
Yeah, so in my write-up, I talked about how the Bills have, you know, kind of established since they were humiliated by the Patriots in that snow game last month. And you know, you can go through the numbers that I put out in the article. But basically, Josh Allen's upside here, I think comes in the rushing game. And, you know, he has seen more rushing attempts per game. In fact, against Atlanta, they kind of maybe you remember this, Matt. They kind of shifted to Allen just running the ball, Josh. We're not throwing it anymore. And he did just that. So and I think, you know, playing against a Patriots right. team that plays a lot of man to man defense, and we know that those sort of defenses are a little bit easier to run on for mobile quarterbacks. I think that we'll see a lot of that this time. And, you know, you can't ask for much more fantasy wise than a guy like Josh Allen taking off in the pocket, you know, maybe, you know, 8-10 times in this game.
I will say that Josh Allen performance in New England, like it was one of those, he put the team on his back and, but a lot of the biggest plays were by really narrow margins. Like he had a few like huge gains where he was like inches from getting sacked and the box score was unbelievable, but that was a game where I feel like two or three plays, I mean, you can say this about any game, obviously, but a lot of those big plays in the game almost didn't happen where he was almost getting like hit for a major sack. And it was such an impressive performance because he really did just like take it upon himself to win that game. But it was by a narrow margin than you might expect from the box score and the final score.
It was a 5-point game until the 230 mark, so both teams were competing. We also saw Damian Harris go over 100 yards in both games. Mac Jones had success on the ground, scrambling as well against the Bills' defense. And really the story was the efficiency the Bills' offense had. They were 6-for-12 in that on third down in that second matchup and 3-for-4 on fourth down. And that aligns with their season-long rates. They finished the year third in conversion rate overall on third down. But the Patriots, who finished 10th overall in third down conversion rate, actually went 1-for-10 in that game. And so I do think we see a little bit of regression. I think it's going to be very, very close. And honestly, like the world watched the Colts-Jags, since it ultimately decided so many other teams' fates, like whoever wins this game, and I don't think it's necessarily the Bills, I think the Patriots are live dogs here, that it is an easy cakewalk to at least potentially represent the AFC in the Super Bowl, because the Bills would go on and play the Chiefs next round, who they've already beat this year. And just the way the Chiefs defense functions, the Bills are the better team in that matchup. Whereas the Patriots would get the Titans, who they already beat this year. And then assuming the Chiefs win the next round and this round, we'd see a showdown between those two in the AFC championship. So the Bills literally had the worst draw possible for their first round matchup. And I am concerned as well.
Devin Singletary has scored in four straight, averaging 21 touches and just under 100 yards from scrimmage during that stretch. But three of those big performances came against the Panthers, Falcons, and Jets. And the quietest game of that four was against the Patriots, Week 16. Daigle, where are you on Singletary heading into this matchup against New England?
Just the fact that he's had 21 touches in three of his last four games. We've seen them take the ball out of Josh Allen's hands the past 2 weeks. And remember, that was when they were trying to clinch a playoff berth and then trying to clinch a home appearance in the playoffs in the first round. And Devin Singletary rode them to multiple touchdowns in both games. Last week, his last two touchdowns came in the last 8 minutes and 30 seconds of that one. And so they are at least showing more willingness and confidence in Singletary as the only true back in that backfield. Zach Moss has been active over Matt Breida, congratulations, for three consecutive games, but he's only had less than five carries in all three of those games. So we're not too worried about Zach Moss getting involved. I have a lot of confidence in Singletary in this matchup. I also think it's interesting because, you know, the playoff-only formats, whether it be best ball or FFPC, they're all the rage right now. And this matchup is so close, honestly, that picking Singletary as a pivot to Josh Allen's interesting because you can lose Singletary in the first round, but if you lose Josh Allen the first round, who's going to be the highest roster quarterback, you're pretty much screwed. And so thinking this game is going to be slowed down, it's going to feel like -3 as of this recording on Thursday in Buffalo. So overall, I think it's just going to be a run-heavy game overall.
Oh, along those lines, Damian Harris, who you mentioned before, closed out the season with 8 touchdowns in his last 5 active games. And he had 4 of those touchdowns against the Bills, including 2 100-plus yard games against Buffalo. Pat, with all that in mind, are we all in on Harris this weekend, and are we out on Ramondre Stevenson heading into this weekend?
No, it's going to have to be both of them like it was in Week 13. Most of the games the Bills lost this year were to the power rushing attacks. They lost to Derrick Henry and the Titans. They lost to Jonathan Taylor and the Colts, who infamously got destroyed. And, of course, the Patriots game where they ran 40 times, 250 yards in the snow. But even the Bucs, their last loss, the Bucs ran 30 times against the Bills. Their vulnerability all year has been the power rush against them. They've been, like, they tried to get their running offense fixed down the stretch. They've been performing better on the ground too, but the Patriots, you know, Mac Jones struggled down the stretch. I know Denny has some data on that. Like, it just, I don't think the Patriots are going to have a curveball to throw here. They know it's going to have to be their rushing attack. That's been their strength all year. It's how they beat these Bills in Buffalo before, and it's going to have to be both of them. It's going to have to be like the classic 1-2 punch scenario for the Patriots, and it has to be on the ground.
Just reiterating something Daigle said a minute ago, this game will almost certainly be very run heavy. This season, so Patriots opponents have the eighth lowest pass rate over expectation this season, and we know that the Patriots on the other side of the ball, they want to establish more than anything in the world. You know, their running run rate on first down is among the highest in the league. So I think that, you know, Harris and by the way, Harris and Singletary are two of the three running backs with the highest fantasy points over expectation over the final 6 weeks of the season. So they've actually performed very well in their respective offenses approaches.
And although they split touches, we've seen that Ramondre Stevenson is sort of an afterthought whenever Damian Harris is healthy. The issue is they both haven't been healthy for a full game since week 12. And in those two contests in week 11 and 12, they split carries down the middle, literally 21 each. And so we'll see what happens. But overall, if you were asked to entrust one, Damian Harris is the right call.
Well, Pat mentioned the Pats passing game struggles down the stretch, and it certainly wasn't pretty for Mac Jones. Well, one game it was just weird for Mac Jones against Buffalo. He only threw three times, but in week 16 in the loss, he got just 4.5 yards per attempt. Danny, give us your stats. Hit us with the numbers. What are your thoughts? I mean, we're just expecting the Patriots to establish, so not going to be pretty for Mac Jones this weekend, we assume.
Yeah, so I'll break it down for you. Instead of throwing a bunch of numbers at you in there in the piece, I will say that Mac Jones, when the Patriots have relied on him, when they couldn't establish a run, mm-hmm. and when they couldn't run a run-heavy offense, has been really, really bad if you look at completion rate over expectation and, of course, expected points added per dropback. Very poor. So that's the goal. You know, obviously, that's Buffalo's goal here, is to put the game on Mac Jones' shoulders. And if they can do that,
right,
it will be fantastic. I have no doubt that Mac Jones cannot beat this Bills offense by himself if it's up to him.
Well, how do you explain the quarterback win in week 13, Denny? How do you explain that quarterback win he had against the Bills?
Yeah, hey, look, Mac Jones was under center. He was taking snaps, and we can't forget that.
We can't.
He only completed 33% of his passes, but nonetheless.
He deserves credit.
He got the job done because he has true grit.
He deserves credit.
All right, we move to Sunday now. The early game is the Eagles at the Bucks. Tampa, according to PointsBet, is an 8.5-point favorite, a total of 46. It is looking like the Bucks will get Leonard Fournette back as he has returned to practice. Last played in week 15, nearly 4 weeks ago. Daigle, are we expecting full workhorse usage here for Lenny, and how does this matchup look for him overall?
I'm excited about this matchup overall. We know Jonathan Gannon leans on zone tendencies, shell tendencies on defense, and we expect Brady to just pick him apart a la Fournette. Remember in the last month, whenever Fournette was healthy, he was averaging 13.5 carries and 7.5 targets as their true bell cow. Like, the offense practically ran through him. The last time they played a zone defense like this in the Colts and Matt Eberflus, remember, like, they just ran the ball through Fournette. He had 4 touchdowns in that game, and that was basically the way they moved it, was by death by paper cuts. Having said that, I like the overall environment quietly. Not to shift teams before everyone talks about everyone else here, but it's a completely different game this time around for the Eagles, because the last time these two teams played, that was the last time before the Eagles flipped the switch on offense and turned 2-2.
Well, so mid-game, not to interrupt you, that was like when the switch flipped. It was the second half of that game against the Bucks, is when it was already over and they went run heavy in the second half.
When you go back and watch, Miles Sanders didn't have a carry. They didn't have a running back carry until the fourth quarter. Even the announcers noted it. And then the next game is when that happened. But to that point, to week 6, the Eagles were throwing the ball on 57% of their downs in one-score game script. And the Bucks now quietly have permitted the third highest rate of 10-yard carry since returning from their bye in week 10, because they've been dealing with so many COVID and injuries in their front 7. Josh Allen went over 100. Cam Newton even had 42 yards. Among backfields the past 2 games, Michael Carter had a few explosive runs. Chuba Hubbard had success as well in week 18. And the Bucks are expected to get Shaq Barrett back after he's missed 2 games with knee and COVID. Lavonte David was designated to return from injured reserve, but there's no guarantee these players are at full strength after missing so much time, especially when they return from significant injuries and the COVID list. So I kind of think the Eagles can have success here as well. And that's not to say they'll win the game, but I like the over, and I still like the Eagles to cover in a number I think is pretty big.
Well, while we're here, while we're on the Eagles, Daigle, I was going to ask you about their backfield. So with Miles Sanders and Jordan Howard both expected to play, what are you expecting from this backfield in a matchup that maybe looks better than the Bucks' reputation would suggest?
Last time we saw Miles Sanders and Jordan Howard together, Sanders was still the workhorse, and it did become a heavy positive game script. So they sort of leaned off of Miles Sanders. Having said that, I think the ball goes more to Jalen Hurts. Like, I think this is more of a Jalen Hurts game rather than trying to prioritize the running backs. And even if Sanders gets you there inside the 10-yard line, we know there are questions about Jordan Howard being used at the goal line, taking away a lot of the fantasy goodness that Sanders would otherwise provide. And I say this to also kick it to Denny, because I know, because I read his column, he has thoughts on Dallas Goedert, and I love them.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, no, I'm all about Dallas Goedert here. Really good matchup, first of all. People are not thrilled with my ranking of him, by the way. I ranked him 3rd on this slate, and boy, they are telling me I am wrong about that.
I'll tell the lawyers to stop posting. They haven't had much to do since the new year started. They've been online a lot.
It is a pretty bold ranking, considering, like, we brought all the big dog tight ends to the table in the wild card round.
That's true.
Like, every elite tight end in the league is here.
That's true. Yeah, right. And which, you know, just on a side note, I think that the two tight end build in GPPs is definitely in play here. You know, he has a 29% target per route run rate since week 11. He's only behind George Kittle in yards per target over that stretch. You know, he gets all of the tight end targets in this offense and against a Bucs defense, allowing almost 8 tight end targets a game. I think that he is just a tremendous, tremendous fantasy prospect, both floor and ceiling wise. You know, if you watch the game, and I watch games, people don't know, you'll see that the Eagles design so many plays, relatively speaking, for a run heavy team, so many plays for Goddard to get out there in space with blockers in front of him. I can see them really turning to that against a Bucs defense, like I said, that has not been great against the tight end for the second half of the season.
All right, shifting back to the Bucs quickly. In that Week 18 win over the Panthers, Gronk and Mike Evans hauled in basically 2/3 of Tom Brady's 326 passing yards. Pat, does this just remain that straightforward and that clear of a pecking order in the playoffs for this passing game?
It does, because even like the backup plans are hurt now. Cyril Grayson is hurt and probably on the wrong side of questionable. Rashad Perriman is practicing, but he has a hip injury. You know, it never made sense that Gronk wasn't posting massive numbers immediately after Chris Godwin's injury, but he's made up for that the final 2 weeks of the regular season. He had 14 catches for 252 yards. Remember last year, he never got rode last regular season the way he did in 2021. Then he did ramp up big time in the playoffs. I think there is a factor of like Tom Brady trusts Rob Gronkowski more than like any member of his family, basically, not to get like too narrative-y in the playoffs, but hard to see how it's not Gronk and Evans dominating targets. And then also Leonard Fournette as a pass catcher, you know, he would have won the running back pass catching crown if not for his injury. And the Eagles actually give up a ton of running back receptions. They allow the third most this season. So I think Leonard Fournette is very much in play to be the number three target, just because that's the way they've used him. And that's the way a place where the Eagles are vulnerable in defense. So yeah, I don't think, I mean, in DFS, you have to get creative on these small playoff slates, but I don't really know which way I would turn behind Gronk, Evans, and Leonard Fournette.
There are two sides to the Evans argument, and one is that he'll be shadowed by Darius Slay, and I'm not someone who really cares about shadow coverage, except that Evans in his career has struggled against shadow coverage, and the last time he played Darius Slay, Slay did hold him to 25 yards receiving. Having said that, I would argue, and this is the side I lean on, that the opportunity is one that we haven't seen for Evans from Tom Brady ever. He only had an 18.5% target share this past game, but played the fewest snaps he's played in a full game all year and was Tampa Bay's only receiver with any amount of end zone targets. He hasn't reached a 28% target share in any game all year because he's been playing alongside Antonio Brown and Chris Godwin. So now, if we're assuming he's a full-time player without those two, like we are perhaps projecting his highest target share by an immense margin throughout the entire season. And so while he may struggle in man-to-man coverage, I also think that there's a real ceiling opportunity here to still get spiked with 2 or 3 touchdowns. And that's sort of the way I lean in, that the matchup is not a concern and I'd rather take the volume. But I can also see people landing on the other side of that.
3 games down, 3 to go. First, we're going to take a very quick break.
Doers, mowing season is here. With Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas-like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas-like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower just $329 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Subscribe to NBC Sports Edge Plus and get every tool for every game. Fantasy, DFS, and betting premium tools are all included in one subscription at one low price. You can subscribe monthly or save 20% on an annual subscription. We have made it easier than ever with more tools than ever to play and wager with confidence with NBC Sports Edge Plus. We move now to the Sunday afternoon game, the Niners at the Cowboys. According to PointsBet, Dallas, 3-point favorite, total of 51, the highest of the weekend, I believe. So it seems like we're all systems go with Dak Prescott after he threw 12 touchdowns with no interceptions the last three games. But oddly, CeeDee Lamb is averaging 3 catches for 54 yards with no scores during that same stretch. Pat, what is going on here?
There's some weird stuff going on there. I guess maybe part of it is just Amari Cooper had been, his involvement had just been like artificially low. Like basically no way Amari Cooper's target share could remain as low as it had been. You know, he finally publicly complained and then they were just shoveling him the rock over the final two games. And CeeDee maybe has had some usage uncertainty. He missed week 12. And he came back and for the first time all year was playing like really heavy snaps in the slot. He was spending time in the slot before week 12, but it really, really ramped up after he missed week 12. And then in week 18, the rug came out under the slot. It was like all Cedric Wilson in the slot. Mm-hmm. So maybe CeeDee is just struggling with his role kind of like changing over the course of the stretch run. And there's no real good explanation for when a player like as good as CeeDee Lamb doesn't pose. I'm sure it's just a variety of small factors and something that will not maintain, but it has been strange. And it doesn't help it like Cedric Wilson is like one of like the better plug and play backups in the league. Like Amari and CeeDee command so much defensive attention that Cedric Wilson, anytime he's got an opportunity because of that, because like the great players in front of him occupying so much coverage, he always makes defenses pay. So it's just a variety of factors to see. It's hard to see it continuing this way, but there's also like no silver bullet that's like, oh, this is gonna be the week that CeeDee Lamb goes nuts.
You actually had a better description than I could have given, because I just think it's like really confusing. And that's kind of all I say is like, I actually don't know which one comes out more. And we've seen since Amari Cooper basically demanded publicly more targets, he has been getting peppered, but even then hasn't been a ceiling play. And so I think people will probably lean CeeDee Lamb because he is the sexier option with the higher ceiling, but overall it's just really tough. Last week, Blake Jarwin, that was his first game off injured reserve, and we did see Dalton Schultz play the fewest snaps and run the fewest routes he ran since Jarwin was out. But I would also argue that we only got 3/4 of the starters. And so in a push-come-to-shove playoff game, I do wonder if Dalton Schultz will sneakily bounce back into his every-down role. And that's the kind of the way I lean, especially since over the last 5 games, he is second on the team in targets behind Amari Cooper. So I like Schultz for a sneaky little blow-up game, but other than that, it's just really hard to decipher between them.
Dalton Schultz is not going to allow Davis Maddock to get the last laugh. He's not. He's just not.
That's true. By the way, Lamb's usage is really maddening. Since week 15, he's run a route on 77% of Dak Prescott's dropbacks. You know, that's not very high for an extremely talented player who should be out there all the time. And, you know, his route participation should be in the 90s easily, right? And no, it's in the 77% range. He's been targeted on 18% of his routes. That's 3% lower than Amari Cooper, and that's flipped, by the way, from the season's first half when you know Lamb had the edge there. So I don't know what's going on with Lamb's usage, but it makes him a really risky play this weekend.
When we look at that big blow up game from Cedric Wilson from week 18, 5 catches, 119 yards, 2 touchdowns, are we just putting that in the past when it comes to making DFS lineups this weekend? Is there anything there that carries over in any of you guys' minds?
You think Daigle said Wilson? Well, they're all GPPs basically this weekend. You can't be playing cash during the playoffs. My God.
Yeah, he ran a route on 71% of Dak's dropback. So maybe there's a little bit of a usage bump here. But overall, remember, we saw a usage bump without Gallup earlier this year, and it didn't result in any ceiling games that we could play him in. Even with like bye weeks going on, Cedric Wilson was a hard pill to swallow. So I think it's more or less a situation you just avoid.
Mm-hmm. Well, it did result in a ceiling games, but he always did have a surprisingly high floor, like always 6 to 7 targets, which you wouldn't necessarily expect for like the fill in emergency number 3 receiver. And seemingly like a nose for the end zone, maybe totally fluky, but 6 touchdowns and 45 catches. So there is at least always floor with Cedric Wilson.
Ezekiel Elliott got 4.8 yards per carry in week 18, his best since week 9. Also had his most rushing yards, 87, since week 5. Also worth noting, Tony Pollard didn't play there. Denny, how are we feeling? What is your column? What does your column tell us about Zeke in this matchup against the Niners?
We're not feeling good, Matt, about Zeke. I actually think this shapes up as a massively pass-heavy offensive approach for Dallas. For each game, I outlined, you know, the EPA allowed for each defense over the final 4 weeks of the regular season. And suffice it to say, the 49ers have been very strong against the run. You also, you know, throw in the fact that among running backs with at least 50% of their team's rushing attempts this season, Zeke is 22nd in breakaway rate and 24th in elusive rating. That's per Pro Football Focus. I mean, that's bottom, very, very bottom of the barrel in both categories. Because, again, we're talking about, you know, guys who have seen 50% of their team's rushing attempts. I don't see, you know, I want to get weird with this slate, with the short slate. And you know, Zeke would qualify as getting weird because he's not cheap. And, you don't see much of a path to, right, to a ceiling. I can't do it. I can't do it, guys. I don't know about you.
They put him out there week 18 to chase his incentives, and it took him 18 carries to get to 80 yards to get the incentive. Like, they were trying to get him out of the game. He couldn't come out of the game because he wasn't rushing for anything. So that was his highest mark since week 5. Very worried about Zeke's ceiling here. If you play him, it's pretty much you're hoping for rushing touchdowns, like, within the 5, and that's about it.
That when you put it that way, he was chasing his incentives and he couldn't get him. That's why his yardage total
was
so high.
He couldn't get them. It took him to the fourth quarter to get them. Very, very quickly, I didn't touch on it with Dak, but I think there is a little bit of a tail going on here, which is why I also think this is a nightmare matchup for Dallas. Pretty much the worst draw they could have had in the first round. And that is, Dak has played 3 games against defenses, creating a bottom 10 pressure rate since he returned from that calf injury in week 9. And those 3 games were his best performances, Falcons, Giants, and Cardinals. Mm-hmm. He didn't really necessarily like do extremely well in them. He didn't go over 300 yards, still had multiple touchdowns in them. The Raiders game you might mention on Thanksgiving, he did have 375 yards, 3 touchdowns, and that was against a top 5 pass rushing team. But also, if you look back at that game, the Raiders literally created the least amount of pressure of any team on Thanksgiving week. So didn't really get to Dak. We know the 49ers are a top 6 team in pressure rate created. So if they get there, I am worried about the passing game here. And given all the stats we mentioned about Zeke, we know like that's how the Cowboys have to win, is via Dak. And I am a little worried.
All right, when the Niners have the football, I mean, we know when they're throwing, we know or running, we know where things stand with Deebo Samuel. Meanwhile, last week, we just saw Brandon Ayuk post his first 100-plus yard game of the season, while George Kittle, after that explosion several weeks back, now has 8 catches for 60 yards combined the last 3 games. Daigle, what's your expectation for Kittle and Ayuk? And if you have any thoughts on Samuel, feel free to throw that in there as well.
Dallas finished number 6 in pass defense DVOA, number 2 in EPA per dropback. Every advanced metric, their passing defense was the one you were terrified of. In hindsight, though, they allowed 4.3 yards per carry to opposing running backs against what we can now see is the second easiest schedule of opposing rushing offenses this year. And so I believe they're still susceptible against the run. And as we know, that's exactly how the 49ers want to attack, whether it be Deebo Samuel, who is getting some more target juice here, 6.7 carries, 7.5 targets in his last 3 games, or Elijah Mitchell, who has averaged 23.5 carries in his last 5 starts around multiple injuries. So I think that's how they're going to attack it. But does George Kittle have a ceiling? Sure. Maybe this is noise, but if you look at how Gronk had success, for instance, against the Cowboys, it was more of an inline tight end. Same for, except, you know, and then you look at Darren Waller and Travis Kelce, who played more wide and slot off the line of scrimmage, and that's how Dallas was able to cover them more with cornerbacks or with Micah Parsons. So we know George Kittle primarily plays inline, and I wonder if that's like the reason, or that's how he's going to explode more in this game. Some may be concerned and look back at his 2 yards per target from this past week, or 2 yards per catch, I should say, but also think back to 2 weeks before that, and he was like literally the best tight end, trying to surpass Mark Andrews in fantasy points per game with a month-long explosion stretch from Jimmy Garoppolo. And so, of course, I still believe he can be the number one tight end scoring on this slate.
It's not that the Cowboys have given up huge running back performances of late, but over the season's final month, They were 22nd in rushing EPA allowed to their opponents. And the 49ers, just to kind of highlight or illustrate how run heavy they want to be, when leading this season, San Francisco has a 42% pass rate. So in a game script, in a situation, and I kind of think this is more likely than not, where the 49ers are you know, can hang in there or even take a lead against Dallas, Elijah Mitchell and Deebo Samuel see tons of usage in this game.
All right, Sunday night on NBC, it's the Steelers at the Chiefs. According to PointsBet, KC favored by 12.5 in a game with a total of 45.5. Tyreek Hill sustained that heel injury during pregame warmups in Week 18. I think freakishly just going up and catching a pass in the end zone. Ended up with one catch for 2 yards. He's been back practicing, but Danny, for DFS purposes, do we just wipe the slate clean and go right back to Tyreek this week in this matchup? And are you willing to put that injury behind you or still concerned about it?
I'm sure that they're going to do everything they can to get him on the field and in his regular capacity. The thing is, though, you know, if the Chiefs, you know, Week 16 win against Pittsburgh is any indication at all of how they're going to approach this game, it's not going to be great for Tyreek from a volume standpoint. He caught 2 of 2 targets in that game, I think for like 17 yards. The Chiefs were very run heavy in that game, which of course sets it up really nicely for whoever is the primary ball carrier for KC in this game. But yeah, in a slate with so many pass catchers with so much upside, especially among the top price guys, I just don't see the appeal of going with Tyreek Hill. I guess unless the thought is that he's okay and that he can do, you know, explode for one of his patented like run after a catch kind of plays. But that just doesn't seem extremely likely to me. I'm out on Tyreek.
Well, as Denny just said, this game potentially sets up nicely for whoever is the primary ball carrier for Kansas City. Let's examine whoever might be the primary ball carrier for Kansas City. Daryl Williams is practicing. CEH didn't practice Thursday. Maybe it gets as simple as that. Maybe that's the clarity we needed. But Pat, I mean, what are we doing with this backfield? I think if it's one guy, we know what we're doing, right? But if they're both in there, what are we doing?
We're waiting for them to re-sign Jamaal Charles. This is getting bleak pretty quickly here in this backfield. We just don't know.
Jamaal Charles would rush for 100 yards on the Steelers right
now. That's actually a very, very, very good point. 6.5 yeah. yards per carry,
JC.
18 carries, be a really big day. And yeah, I mean, unfortunately, with the time we're recording it, we just need more information. The midweek downgrade, very bad news, of course, for Clyde Edwards-Helaire. It could mean one of two things, though. It could just be part of a pre-planned maintenance routine for a player who hasn't played in a while, doing everything they can to make sure he is ready to go for Sunday. You know, these practice reps are meaningless. Or it could be that he didn't respond well to his return on Wednesday. Or I can't remember if he practiced. Did he practice at all near the end of the season? Either way, it could be like not – it could be that his shoulder just was not feeling good on Thursday after practicing Wednesday. So always a very bad sign. The midweek downgrade is never good. There are occasional – charitable interpretations. And if he's back out there on Friday, I feel like maybe then the interpretation was that Thursday was just a planned rest day all along. But yeah, basically we just need more information. And the toe, it was like a new issue for Daryl Williams. Toe is always a very, very tricky thing for a running back, and kind of waiting for like more reports on the situation, definitely waiting for more practice reports on the situation. And just kind of like in wait and see mode as we build DFS lineups with this one. And they're both active. I mean, it's hard to see Clyde Edwards-Helaire after missing all that time and then not even getting a full week of practice. It's kind of hard to see him assuming like a lead back workload, is it not? And you'd have to think that they're going to err on the side of Daryl Williams, but the problem is it's just pure guesswork right now.
I have a little more confidence in Edwards-Helaire's or Tyreek Hill's availability since they were both downgraded on Thursday. If it was just one or the other, I would say, okay, that's a setback. But maybe it was, like you mentioned, predetermined since both of them were downgraded. Hill went from full to Hill went from limited to Hill was limited on Thursday. So overall, we're going to wait for Friday. That's going to be the ultimate judgment here. But yeah, we'll see what happens, because we know Daryl Williams has averaged 7 targets, 13.5 carries, handled 71% of the team's backfield touches, and 6 full starts without Clyde Edwards-Helaire this year, whereas Edwards-Helaire averaged 14 carries in the games he played alongside Daryl Williams. So We'll see if we get one or the other, because that's going to determine what we do in this backfield, because we want pieces of it for sure.
Yes. Real quick, in that previous matchup between the Chiefs and Steelers, the Chiefs had a 48% pass rate, which is 14% lower than their season-long rate.
On, you know, these two games, three, well, on this case, it'd be a three game for Sunday, and five games DFS, like, you got to get a little weird as well. You got to save some salaries since there are a lot of expensive players on the board. I don't even mind pairing, let's say, Darrell Williams with Derek Gore, thinking that that's the game script that's going to happen.
Yes. Now we're talking. Now we're getting weird.
Finally, we're getting weird. By the way, Jamal Charles, younger than Adrian Peterson. Let's make this happen. Let's make this happen. I'm ready.
And Jamal happens to be the greatest running back to ever play. You know, so there's that.
Adrian Peterson, maybe not 100, but 80 against the Steelers right now.
All right, well, the time has come to address the Steelers offense, and I think we should start with Najee Harris, who the last 4 weeks has seen his rushing yards go like this: 18, 93, 188, 28. Daigle, can we make a case for Najee in DFS when it feels like he's much more floor than ceiling at this point?
It's literally just that. You're taking the floor, you're taking the touch floor if you play him this week. And I don't want to continue dunking on the Steelers, but we literally just saw this same matchup, and their offense has only gotten worse since. So I don't have confidence that we'll get a competitive game or like a even a middle-of-the-road performance from Najee. Pat, do you have any thoughts?
Well, so I don't know if you heard, but, you know, no one believes in the Steelers, so AKA they're going to win. That's kind of how it works, according to
Ben Roethlisberger. It was, to see the headline, Roethlisberger thinks Steelers don't have a chance, was pretty funny.
He was being about as, I mean, a guy who's always pretty passive-aggressive ramped it up to about 1,000 on that. So he is upset. He's mad.
He was pretty, he seemed like a guy who's getting ready to retire on Monday.
He seemed like, yeah, that he's mad about the extra game. And, like, maybe now it's, like, motivation, like, he didn't want to play this game. So now he's so mad that he goes out there and is just good. The Steelers are going to win.
Well, Danny, I don't know why. Danny, for some reason, the Steelers pass catchers question always seems to land on you. So how does this matchup look for Deontay Johnson, Pat Freiermuth, Chase Claypool, or any of these three that you're at all bullish on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you forget Chase Claypool. Just forget he's even in the player pool. I've tried
so many times.
I've tried, and now I have succeeded. You know why? Because Ray McLeod is in the player pool, and that's where we're going. He's been the number two guy for a while now in that offense. So if we get a game full of checkdowns from the master of checkdowns, Ben Roethlisberger, then it's going to be Deontay Johnson and McLeod getting those short area targets. Read my column for more Ray McLeod propaganda. I really, really got overzealous there, I think. But Johnson and McLeod, I think they have some pretty decent prospects here. Deontay Johnson had some garbage time production, you know, last time these teams played. He's always good for that. And you know, we can't complain too much about that.
I have heard your words, but I will say I don't think I can quit Claypool just yet.
No.
Since, you know, we still got the route participation increasing progressively in five consecutive games, so much so that he ran around on 96% of dropbacks this past week, played a season high 91% of snaps this past week as well. So I don't know if I can quit Claypool just yet, admittedly.
Hey, we've only waited.
The targets are not good.
We've waited 18 weeks. Finally, we're about to get that Chase Claypool explosion. Here it comes.
It took to the wild card last year. Recall that 2-touchdown performance.
Listen, I'm going to be sick to my stomach if he goes off. I mean it. Like, somebody needs to call me if that happens and make sure I'm okay.
He'll be asleep already. It's fine.
We mentioned the Sunday Night 7 earlier in the podcast, a chance to win $1 million there. The Chiefs are 12.5-point favorites. Producer Adam tells me this is apparently the largest spread points bet has ever posted in a wild card game. So let's go around the room and answer that Sunday Night 7 question. Who wins this game, and by how many points? Pat, why don't you lead it off, and we'll go around the room.
Well, I know it's not the biggest spread ever for a playoff game, because my Rams were 2-touchdown favorites against the Patriots in the 2002 Super Bowl and then lost. The Chiefs will win, but I actually think they might not cover. I just kind of feel like a slog. I'm feeling like a 9 or 10-point Chiefs victory, so still a convincing enough victory, but maybe not the blowout like it was a few weeks ago.
If it is close, like, remember, this is the biggest underdog since we saw the Marshawn Lynch Seattle Seahawks enter the Superdome and upset the Saints. I don't think that's the case here. I will still take the Chiefs by 3 scores. But, yeah, an upset here would be, I mean, catastrophic.
All right. Listen. I talked to my dad today.
Oh, here he goes.
One of my thoughts on the games. I said, well, look, I think the Steelers, you know, the Steelers will cover. I'm very, you know, confident in that. And he said, well, stranger things have happened. And I said, no, as far as an outright win for the Steelers, I said, no, stranger things have not happened. This would be the strangest thing. So yeah, Steelers win.
I would just like to note the Lions and Texans led for more snaps than the Steelers this year. So just be very wary about why and how this Steelers team snuck into the postseason.
And listen, as long as I don't have to take responsibility for this, I'm saying Steelers win.
You're fired.
It does feel like the Steelers might succeed in like roping KC into just a little bit, not necessarily the win, but like where it's a little sweatier than you'd like it to be if you're a KC fan.
The Broncos, you know, held on last week. The Chiefs are all sorts of banged up. I'm just putting it out there.
The good news is for the Steelers is they can't fall behind 28-0 in the first quarter like they did the last time they were in the
final. I would say that's a key to winning is not falling behind 4 touchdowns immediately.
Okay, the last game on this 6-game slate is Monday night, the Cardinals at the Rams. Friends at PointsBet have the Rams as 4-point favorites, a total of 49.5. The Cardinals put up 30 last week, but it was a quiet day for Kyler Murray, really another quiet day, you might say, in that loss to Seattle. 240 yards, 1 passing touchdown, threw for just 7 touchdowns over his final 7 games. Daigle, I want to ask you this. Do you like any of Kyler's pass catchers to get there against the Rams?
It's just been so hard because we've seen the DeAndre Hopkins splits now be proven as more than just simple offensive regression since Murray was so efficient through the air, whether it be their red zone scoring, third down percentage, or deep balls. We've now seen that Hopkins is truly affecting this offense, or at least his absence is. And so that's why Zach Ertz leads the team in targets without Hopkins over this last month of the season, but also, you know, in averaging 9 yards per catch. Like we mentioned with Josh Jacobs, he's just getting nowhere, not being a ceiling play either. And so the explosiveness is really lacking here. So for the top pass catcher, I still think Ertz leads in targets. You got to hope for a few spike performance from Christian Kirk, who's not really proving like as a full-time deep ball threat. He can do that without Hopkins. But overall, yeah, that's what we're kind of trying to figure out is how the Cardinals are going to get offense. And I think it comes from their backfield, more importantly, pending what happens with James Conner and Chase Edmonds. But overall, I am concerned about the explosiveness with this offense here.
Well, that backfield is trending toward potentially being a headache because James Conner did get something closer to that workhorse usage against Seattle, 21 touches, 93 yards, 2 touchdowns. But he's now a game time decision as of Thursday due to a rib injury. Chase Edmonds injured as well. He says he's going to play. What are we doing with this backfield, Pat? Are we just waiting as well, just like we were with the Chiefs backfield, or what's the story here?
There's like slightly less uncertainty than there is with the Chiefs backfield because Chase Edmonds has guaranteed he'll play, even though Cliff Kingsbury said he was going to be a game time decision. So we learned with Cliff Kingsbury, that was not a very meaningful title when it came from him. He was calling everyone game time decisions in the second half of the season, and players were like quite frequently, obviously, going to play. It does seem, especially with this extra day of rest, it's maybe the one good thing about having a Monday night wild card game, you know, a huge rest disadvantage for the divisional round. They do have a rest advantage for the wild card round. It seems like Edmonds is going to play. Connor's a different story. He got hurt in mid-game, didn't return, hasn't practiced this week. His teammates are saying he's probably going to play. He's a guy who's missed so much time in his career, but you know, this is one of the biggest games of his career. He'll probably be out there, but I don't really see how he could be the lead back. Like it seems like a fairly serious rib issue. I mean, ribs always a big concern for running back, but they'll slap the flak jacket on him, but much more confident, at least as a Thursday afternoon, in Chase Edmonds' ability to play. And even though James Conner, you know, had deserved to be like that early down, the clear early down lead back, I think it's going to be Chase Edmonds this week.
Conner averaged 20.5 touches and 5 starts without Chase Edmonds, and Edmonds averaged 17 carries and 7.5 targets in weeks 16 and 17 without Conner. So ideally we get one or the other, and right now that would be Edmonds without Conner. But if we get both, yeah, perhaps they scale down Conner's touches overall, but that would be a conundrum for sure.
And he would probably have – so it could be the classic Daigle. Edmonds has the touch advantage, but Conner has the red zone, the goal line advantage.
Just like we saw when both were healthy earlier in the year, yeah.
As for the Rams, beyond Cooper Kupp, is there a Rams pass catcher you're especially bullish on, Denny, after Cooper Kupp? And is the answer to that question Tyler Higbee?
You act like you know me, man. And it's insulting. But yes, it's Tyler Higbee. And actually, I actually wrote up Van Jefferson as well in my column, if folks would like to check that out. Anyway, let me tell you about Higbee's recent usage, which is even better than I thought before I looked into it. Since he kind of came on as a viable fantasy option, really, in week 13, he's been targeted on 23% of his routes. That's second only to Cooper Kupp in this Rams offense. He had been targeted on 17% of his routes from week 1 to 12. So a huge increase from 17 to 23% there. You know, the problem here is that the Cardinals are a really, really tough tight end matchup. You know, they give up the lowest target share to tight ends in the whole league. I will say that I also told people not to play Higbee last week against the Niners, who are actually the worst tight end matchup. So maybe that doesn't matter as much here, since Sean McVay seems pretty intent on getting Higbee involved. Another thing, just DFS-wise, it's really hard to land on Higbee when you have so many good tight end plays on the slate.
Dallas Goedert, just to name one. Sorry, go ahead.
It's just interesting since, you know, Sean McVay is 5-1 against Cliff Kingsbury. The Rams have scored 30-plus points in 4 of those 6 matchups, including their most recent one in Week 14, which arguably was the last time we saw Stafford splice together a true, complete, stellar performance. That was also the last time we really saw Beckham put together a ceiling game. So that's what makes it so interesting for this matchup, that you would think it favors the Rams, but also Stafford dealing with a toe injury, struggling in every other game, like in his last 6 starts around that one, then there's just no guarantee that we get a full Rams onslaught here at full health.
Especially if they're going to have to play with the silent count and get it home. But I don't think the Arizona Cardinals fans are very famous for traveling and taking over stadiums. So hopefully it will not be a factor.
There will
for the
be
Rams.
More Steelers fans than Rams fans in that stadium.
That's a really good point. For some reason, the whole stadium is the Steelers fans on Monday night.
We saw Sony Michel struggle somewhat for the first time since he took over as the lead back. 21 carries for 43 yards last week against the Niners. Daigle, was that really matchup specific in your mind, or are you concerned about anything you saw from Sony there?
I believe Cam Akers is going to get steamed as a popular DFS option, since when you look at the showdown slate, and I've already looked ahead to everything ahead of Friday's show, Cam Akers is basically almost minimum, and all you need is a touchdown to get that performance. And we saw 13 snaps, 8 touches this past game, which pretty much ruins Sony Michel's chances of sticking around as a strong RB1, because we think Akers is at least going to have his role increase this next game as well. I don't think it's going to be more than half the touches, but even getting up to 30 or 40% is a concern. So, and more importantly, we saw Cam Akers not look ready. Like, tremendous story, but also just 13 yards on those 8 touches as well. Not good. And so I would worry, even in Akers getting more touches, like Derrick Henry, which we'll talk about next week, I would still worry about him getting those touches and being at full strength.
All right. That's the end of 6 games. Now, Daigle has another thing. Yeah.
I mean, nothing needs to be said, but did we just go a whole Rams preview without saying Cooper Kupp's name?
I said his name.
The God amongst us.
Yeah, you know, I don't think he's good anymore, though. He didn't set the receiver record even with an extra game. So it was actually a disappointing season.
I did mention his name, but I mean, it seriously, like I didn't feel the need to really ask anything just because it seems like such a foregone conclusion. But if you have insight with this matchup, feel free.
John, have you tinkered with building lineups with him in it? Because I have, and I don't like it. I don't like it at all.
You want to hear a funny Cooper Kupp stat? He was held under 90 yards one time all season. And it was at home against the Cardinals in week 4, folks.
The hard part is, though, that now that we pretty much lost Sony Michel for playoff-only fantasy, you just can't go anywhere else. Like, you can't even argue, really, Tyler Higbee as your one player from the Rams over Cooper Kupp, despite the usage Diddy mentioned. So I think you still just suck it up and play Cooper Kupp. Who cares about the fade?
All right. What's coming up this weekend in the days ahead on the podcast and elsewhere?
Danny's article, man. That's where it's at.
That's it.
And we're getting a walkthrough from Mr. Crane, I think.
It's a lot.
Okay, thank God.
Yep. Oh, and Pat Crane and I will do a Twitter Spaces situation together on Friday. So check that out.
You'll be too late for this on a Thursday evening. I'm doing one Thursday night with Warren Sharp and Sarah Perlman, but I will be doing another one then a Monday afternoon with Lawrence Jackson and Kyle Dvorak. So check out our Twitter Spaces Monday afternoon.
I have my – Jenny has his rankings article for the wild card. My rankings are for playoff-only leagues. So how I believe the brackets and your overall, if you're forced to choose like one player from every team, how those formats will shake out. And so I will be adjusting those rankings until Saturday morning. I just recently updated them Thursday afternoon. We'll do so again on Friday. So check that out on the site. And DFS building blocks still coming at you Friday afternoon.
All right, that'll do it for us. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, wherever you listen. Take a second to rate and review us as well. I want to say thanks to everyone for listening and for watching live with us. Pat Daigle, Denny, thanks to all of you guys. Good luck this weekend, everyone.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.